It is Tuesday, July 17th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Sarah Williams in Washington. Coming up, President Donald Trump insists he had a productive meeting with Russian President Vladimir Putin despite widespread criticism of his siding with Moscow's assertion that it did not interfere in the 2016 presidential election. We get perspective on Trump's recent meeting with North Korean leader Kim Jong-un.
There will always be a certain level of equivalence between a North Korean dictator and a president of the United States.
And the classic 1965 Ford Mustang car gets self-driving capabilities. It's all ahead. President Donald Trump said Tuesday he had a great summit with Russian President Vladimir Putin in Helsinki. But the American president faced a wave of condemnation for siding with Putin's denial that Moscow meddled in the 2016 presidential election, rather than the U.S. intelligence community's conclusion that Russia had interfered. Speaker Paul Ryan, leader of the Republican majority in the House of Representatives, continued to rebuke the stance he took alongside Putin at a closing news conference at Monday's summit in Helsinki.
We just conducted a year-long investigation into Russia's interference in our elections. They did interfere in our elections. It's really clear. There should be no doubt about that. It's also clear that it didn't have a material effect on our elections. But as a result of that, we passed tough sanctions on Russia so that we can hold them accountable. I understand the desire and the need to have good relations. That's perfectly reasonable. But Russia is a menacing government that does not share our interests, and it does not share our values. And I think that should be made very, very clear.
A wide array of Republican and Democratic lawmakers condemned Trump's position, calling it embarrassing, a disgrace, and shameful. Well, meanwhile, how are Europeans reacting to Monday's summit between President Trump and Russian leader Putin? Reporter Jamie Detmer in London gives me the details.
A mixture of alarm and relief. They are relieved Europeans that the U.S. leader didn't give away any aces. There have been concerns that he may give some concrete concessions to Putin, which he didn't. But they remain very queasy about what they see as Trump's apparent eagerness to get on with the Russian leader. And they compare that to the very combative tone he's used towards them, particularly last week at the NATO summit, where he was pretty harsh and hard on them and berated them about their lack of defense spending, and also brought up his concern that the Europeans have a too large trade surplus with America, and they should be lowering their tariffs on U.S. goods.
Yes, I believe there was an interview he gave with CBS News on Sunday, I think, where he actually called the European Union foes.
Well, he said they were a greater foe than Russia and China. This prompted from the German Foreign Ministry a rebuke and saying that now the Germans and the Europeans need to close ranks with each other and would have to start considering the possibility that the Trump-led United States is an adversary. Now, I mean, there's a lot of confusion about what Trump meant about foe. Some leaders, some European leaders and officials are consoling themselves with the idea that when he says foe, he means competitor as opposed to enemy. But one of the growing concerns amongst and anxiety amongst European leaders and officials are these strains in the ties between Europe and America. And they're trying to understand whether this is just Trump's way of wheeling and dealing to secure deals he wants, which is what some American officials are saying to the Europeans behind the scenes. Don't take this too seriously. This is the way he operates. This is his style. But others are concerned that it's more than that, that there's an ideological underpinning whereby Trump really is questioning the whole foundation of the relationship between Europe and America. I have one analyst saying that he felt that in the end, Trump is such a transactional president that he doesn't really feel he needs or wants allies, that he is suggesting promiscuous when it comes to foreign policy. Everything is transactional and transactional in the moment. And if you operate like that, then you don't really see much purpose in having long-term relationships or even really having allies.
I also think some of the reaction in this country to what transpired yesterday at the talks between the two leaders, they were alone for a while, except for their interpreters. And there's been some speculation as to what they really discussed there. Is that a similar reaction in Europe?
Well, up to a point it is. I heard Jeremy Greenstock today, who's a former top British diplomat. He was the envoy to the UN for the UK for many, many years, who was saying that he wasn't worried about the president seeking to forge a personal relationship with the Russian leader. He was concerned about the way Trump was doing it, and particularly his tendency to be very critical to the Europeans. I think we should put into context this one-on-one meeting. Actually, it hasn't been unusual for Russian and US presidents to have one-on-one meetings. The length of this one was kind of long. But I was reading an interview with a longtime Russian interpreter who interpreted at a large number of summit meetings between the US and Russian leaders, going back to Ronald Reagan. And there was a tendency for them to have a one-on-one, generally of about half an hour.
Jamie Detmer reporting from London. Here are some of the top news stories that are trending. The European Union and Japan sign a landmark trade deal. The United States charges a Russian woman with conspiracy to infiltrate American organizations. Britain's official Brexit campaign is sanctioned for violating campaign spending laws, and Hong Kong moves to ban a pro-independence political party. Expanded coverage of these stories and more are on the voanews.com website. This is VOA.
This is Science in a Minute.
Members of the science community are proclaiming a new era in space research after discovering the first source of a subatomic particle called a high-energy neutrino. Using ground and space-based telescopes, a global team of scientists was able to trace the path of one of these particles to a flaring supermassive black hole in the center of a galaxy some 3.7 billion light-years away. The neutrino itself was detected at the Ice Cube Neutrino Observatory in Antarctica. According to the National Science Foundation, a new system that sends alerts to telescopes around the world was activated in less than a minute after the subatomic particle crashed into one of the observatory's deep underground detectors. The alert included the neutrino's incoming coordinates. The discovery comes after astronomers spent decades trying to detect and find out where and how these ghostly little particles are generated. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
This is International Edition on the Voice of America. I'm Sarah Williams. Coming up, a U.S. general says he does not advocate a direct role in negotiations with the Taliban. This week's controversial meeting between President Trump and Russian President Putin followed last month's summit in Singapore between Trump and North Korean leader Kim Jong-un. Those talks ended with the United States offering security guarantees to North Korea and promising to end its military drills with South Korea. Paul French is the author of the 2014 book North Korea, State of Paranoia. I asked him what Pyongyang got out of the Singapore summit.
Pyongyang got exactly what it wanted. It got the photo. It got the photo of the president of the United States. Doesn't really matter to them what president it is, but then he's the one that gave them the photo opportunity. And so now on, whatever happens at the next election and whatever happens in the future, there will always be a certain level of equivalence between a North Korean dictator and a president of the United States. And we've never had that before. You know, going back to the early 2000s and Clinton's negotiations with North Korea, it was Madeleine Albright that came, you know, or emissaries such as former President Carter that were sent, or secretaries of state of various sort, or diplomats. So that in itself is a big win for North Korea, and I would argue is not only a big loss for the United States, but is a big loss for all of us that don't really, you know, approve of the system in North Korea or see an equivalence between our systems and their systems. And also, I think, doesn't help the situation of the 22, 23 million North Korean people who don't have a say in the future of their country as well. So that was the first big win for them. The second big win for them, which again, was that the president seems to have walked away and declared declared victory and that denuclearization is going to occur without the North Koreans ever themselves actually saying that that was going to happen. For them, it was not really a meeting of any substantive negotiations. It was in, out, get that photo and done. Now, there's going to have to be a lot of work done to negotiate anything now about denuclearization with North Korea, because North Korea has had everything it wants. And I think North Korea also perceives the president as having had what he wants, because they don't always understand that there's a vibrant media in the United States. So the fact that the president has come back and said North Korea is no longer a nuclear problem without any substantive evidence for that, it is going to create a problem now, because North Korea will say, well, we don't need to do anything because the president's had his win, or so it seems, and we'll go right on with our nuclear weapons program. And as American intelligence services have said, they don't know everything about North Korea, but they know a lot, which is very interesting that they release that, because it lets North Korea know that we know, if you like, what they're doing. That, you know, uranium enrichment has carried right on, and in fact perhaps increased in the weeks since the Singapore summit.
And I know officials are discussing between the two countries about the repatriation of the bodies, the remains of the U.S. soldiers from the Korean War.
Yeah, I think there are so many issues around this that are stumbling blocks and things that need to be achieved. And of course, repatriation of war remains, as well as issues dating back to that time, like family reunions between North and South Korea. For the Japanese, there's still the issue of kidnapped citizens. So there's lots and lots of these issues that are very important to people and very important to the process of trust and bringing North Korea back into the world community. But at the same time, where we're not getting anywhere at the moment is on denuclearization. And part of the reason that I think we're not getting anywhere on denuclearization is that the president sort of called it before it happened. He called it a victory before we had actually got any signatures down on paper, any verification, or any sort of commitment, serious commitment from the North Koreans.
Author Paul French. A U.S. official said Tuesday the Pentagon is expecting to repatriate from North Korea the remains of as many as 55 American soldiers who were killed during the Korean War. U.S. military information indicates that more than 7,000 troops remain missing from the war, which took place from 1950 to 1953. The commander of U.S. and NATO forces in Afghanistan, General John Nicholson, said reports he advocates a direct U.S. role in negotiations with the Taliban mischaracterized his views. Nicholson said he was merely reaffirming earlier comments by Secretary of State Mike Pompeo, who, during a stop last week in Kabul, said the U.S. is ready to work with the Taliban, the Afghan government, and the Afghan people towards lasting peace. The Taliban insurgency, which has been battling U.S.-led international forces since 2001, has rejected peace talks with President Ashraf Ghani, calling his government illegitimate. The New York Times said the Trump administration has ordered diplomats to seek direct talks to jumpstart negotiations. Nazif Shahrani is an Afghan-born professor of anthropology and Central and Middle Eastern cultures at Indiana University. He tells International Edition's Victor Beatty he's not surprised at reports the U.S. is ready to talk to the Taliban or shocked at the immediate retraction.
What is interesting in all of this is the response of the Taliban representative in Qatar, in Doha, who was very pleased and eager, essentially, to get Americans to talk with them directly. And more importantly, he was saying that Ashraf Ghani's government is illegitimate and that they're not going to involve any kind of talks with them. And this is exactly the voice that is being aired now domestically, not just by Taliban, but by a very large segment of the population in the north, which has been in turmoil for the last 2 weeks or more because of an arrest that was made of a local commander, a very effective one at that, who was fighting the Taliban. So the legitimacy issue of Afghan government is now more than ever, I think, an issue. And the United States, if it's going to join the talks now or later, has to remember that the party who fought the Taliban before the American intervention were not the southern Pashtun population of the country, but rather the non-Pashtun populations in central Afghanistan, western Afghanistan, and northern Afghanistan. and that they are questioning the legitimacy of Ashraf Ghani's government at this moment.
What do the Taliban hope to gain by direct talks with the U.S.?
They want to essentially dismiss the existing government in Kabul as illegitimate. Therefore, they are the legitimate power. And if America is willing to negotiate with them, they basically have won. That's their victory. And that they will supposedly determine the future of the country and not the government that the United States and NATO forces have been supporting for the last 17 years in that country at a huge cost.
The statement from the NATO U.S. commander, General Nicholson, said that his comments have been mischaracterized. The U.S. is not a substitute for the Afghan people or government. This must be an Afghan-led process. Obviously, we're back to square one.
Yes, absolutely. And I'm glad that he's mentioning the Afghan people and not the government, because the Afghan people means a very large segment of the country who had opposed the Taliban and probably will be opposed to the return of the Taliban without some kind of constitutional arrangement in which they will have the right for community self-governance.
Nazif Shahrani said there have been no direct talks on peace for 3 years. Meanwhile, he said the fighting is intense, with hundreds of casualties of Afghan security force personnel on a weekly, even daily basis, spanning 8 or 9 provinces simultaneously. This is VOA.
When news breaks, VOA Africa is there, bringing you news as it happens. Listen to Africa News Tonight, Monday through Friday at 1600 and 1800 UTC. And our 5-minute newscasts come to you at the top of each hour. VOA Africa, your trusted source of information.
Hi, I'm Nikki Strong. You love music? How about Blake Shelton and Carrie Underwood? Or Merle Haggard and Loretta Lynn? Experience the best in country music on Country Hits USA. I bring you some country rock, outlaw, a little hillbilly, contemporary, and more, with a dash of entertainment news, too. So join me for Country Hits USA on VOA 1, the voice of America.
This is International Edition. Scientists from Cranfield University in Britain have teamed up with the engineering firm Siemens to retrofit a classic 1965 Ford Mustang with driverless technology. They recently tested it on a racetrack at the Goodwood Festival of Speed, considered the largest motoring garden party in the world. VOA's Julie Tabo has more.
This classic 1965 Ford Mustang is actually driving itself, which might explain the uneven steering and occasional near misses. Behind the wheel, as a safety precaution, is Dr. James Brighton of Cranfield University. Working with engineering firm Siemens, Brighton and his team retrofitted the vintage Mustang with a suite of autonomous driving technology.
We have a mixture of different sensors that are locating it in space. We can't use GPS alone because there's too much tree cover, etc. So we have to look at fusing different sensors and then coming up with an algorithm that will determine the best sense of what all those are telling you to try and make the best decision as to where it is at any point in time, and then make control decisions based on that.
Brighton adds that the car's 50-year-plus lifetime gave it a number of driving quirks that created extra challenges for engineers.
A lot of work had to be put into the algorithms and the control in order to try and manipulate the car's performance to an acceptable level.
Siemens says the project demonstrates the potential for autonomous systems to be retrofitted for use in industrial applications.
The reason why we're involved in this technology overall is, of course, not that we're in the business of retrofitting classic cars, but the fact that we want to increasingly help apply autonomy to factory environments. It could be to other large industrial environments, quarries, for example, where you could have autonomous vehicles. And there, the opportunity to be able to retrofit autonomy and make existing vehicles in factories or turn them robotic in those environments, we can test and prove with technology like this.
But Brighton says driving a Mustang is different.
I think most of the fun of an old classic car is getting behind the wheel and driving it.
And that's why, he says, the car has the option to be driven in both manual and autonomous mode.
essentially arms the system, just here, and then we can switch from autonomous or automated to manual modes.
At the 25th Goodwood Festival of Speed in southern England, the self-driving Mustang was challenged to complete the famous hill climb course. Despite a few steering corrections, the car successfully completed the nearly 2 kilometer trek without incident, and in great style. Julie Tabo, VOA News.
Thanks very much, Julie. Well, the United States Census Bureau says that in American families where the wife makes more money than the husband, there's a tendency for the men to exaggerate their income when responding to income surveys, as opposed to what they report to the Internal Revenue Service. A news release says when a wife earns more, both husbands and wives exaggerate the husband earnings and diminish the wife's. But husbands overstate their own earnings less than wives do, and wives devalue their own earnings less than their husbands do. According to the research, men whose wives earn more than they do pump their incomes by an average of 2.9% compared to what they reported to the IRS. For example, a man who reported $30,000 in income to the IRS would add about $870 when reporting to the Census Bureau. If that man's wife reported $40,000 in income to the IRS, they would tell Census that their income was $39,400, a $600 difference. This, researchers say, could skew policy because wage and earnings data underlie a majority of federal statistics on income inequality and poverty. Well, that is our show for today. Please visit our website at voanews.com. I'm Sarah Williams. Thanks so much for joining us.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
On July 9th, Eritrean President Isaias Afwerki and Ethiopian Prime Minister Abiy Ahmed determined to resolve the differences between their countries by signing a peace accord that will end 2 decades of hostilities. For 5 years after Eritrea achieved its independence from Ethiopia by referendum in 1993, the two countries enjoyed cordial relations. But a 1998 dispute over border issues escalated into a vicious war that cost over 80,000 lives. The hostilities ceased in 2000, but the two countries maintained a military stalemate over the disputed territory. Aside from an end to the long-running hostilities, a peace agreement would result in significant benefits for both countries. Ethiopia is a landlocked country, but good relations with Eritrea would afford it access to Assab and Massawa, ports on the Red Sea, one of the world's busiest shipping routes from Asia to Europe via the Suez Canal. Eritrea, on the other hand, would have the opportunity to improve its economy, which had been severely damaged by the war with Ethiopia and hamstrung by the subsequent stalemate. The country is isolated, and many Eritreans have emigrated. The United States welcomes the July 9th commitment to peace and security between the State of Eritrea and the Federal Democratic Republic of Ethiopia, effectively ending 20 years of conflict, said U.S. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo in a written statement. We commend Prime Minister Abiy of Ethiopia and President Isaias of Eritrea for courageously leading their citizens toward peace, prosperity, and political reform. The normalization of relations and the adoption of the Joint Declaration of Peace and Friendship between Eritrea and Ethiopia will provide their peoples with the opportunity to focus on shared aspirations for closer political, economic, and social ties, said Secretary Pompeo. The United States stands ready to support this process and encourages all parties to continue working with transparency and confidence in the coming days. Peace between Ethiopia and Eritrea will further the cause of stability, security, and development in the Horn of Africa and Red Sea.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.